The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Okay, it's 8:30, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. Good morning, everybody. I just got here last night at midnight, so I have no idea what's been going on. I've been at a different conference all week. So I just crawled out of bed and got dressed and came down here. So I'm completely disconnected from the great conversation you've been having already this week. But I came here to just do this one talk to help answer. I got the idea for this last year when a friend of mine began teaching physics for the first time, and his first act was to get the standard lab manual out and go buy all the equipment needed to do those labs. And I thought, when he told me that he'd done that, I thought, oh, I wish he'd talk to me first. Now you got a bunch of stuff that you're going to grow tired of in a few years, and you're just going to be looking for how to start over. So that's when I got the idea for this talk and put this together. So I hope to share some ideas with you that you can just take back and do this fall. I am going to show you some explosions, but as I tell my students, they happen in May, so you have to wait all year. You have to wait till the end to see them. So my name is John Mays. I just finished 12 years of teaching at Regent School of Austin. I've been there. I'm the only physics teacher they've ever had. I really like it. I teach ninth grade a class in physical science that is physics and chemistry, introductory. For accelerated students, so I have a lot of strong opinions about how that should be done, and I have a book about it. Actually, I have three books now. I'll mention them at the end of the talk and ask you to do me a favor by looking at my website and reading about them. I also have a newsletter that I produce six times a year, so it's been going for a year and a half now. I send it out by email. It's free. I try to make the articles real substantive about science and math, everything from practical to philosophical. I would love it if all of you would put your email addresses on my distribution list so that I can begin sending those to you in the future. And so I'll mention this again at the end, but I've got a sign-up sheet here where you can... some of you I know are already on it, so I would love to get the rest of you on there too. My company is Novare Science and Math, so... let's get started. Before we get to the good stuff, how can we do some fun experiments that are solid, cheap, and fun? Let's talk about some of the problems with using this standard stuff. So when I first started teaching physics, it was in the public school, and it was 1989. And I did the same thing my friend did. I went out and bought all the standard stuff. And so you've got these timers and ticker tapes and all this stuff, and this is what I found. This equipment is boring. The students don't understand it. It's never seen anywhere else except here. I mean, where else in the world do you have a little magnetic ticker that makes dots on a strip of paper, and you have to measure the distance between the dots and correlate that to the velocity? Wow. I remember the first time doing that thinking, okay, I'm confused as a teacher, and I'm an engineer for figuring this out. I know my ninth graders are just going, good grief, someone let us out of here, and I never want to see those things again. It's specialized. You don't use this kind of equipment. My philosophy is I'm training students that I want to become scientists and engineers. I want them to go do that. Every time I have a chance, I want to put an object in front of them that an actual engineer would use, you know, a function generator or something like that actually has the knobs on it, you know, not some fake little box that you get from a science company that has three switches for setting the frequency. Get a function generator if you can. Okay, that's a little more expensive, but that's just kind of the way I think. So I try to develop labs that use real stuff rather than fake stuff. The experiments are boring and they seem contrived, so why can't we come up with experiments that deal with real objects? So that's another piece of my philosophy. This outline, I think, is in your book, right? Yes. So I don't intend to just like read all these. I want to get on to the other stuff. But these are problems that I've noticed over the years. Look at the next to the last one. This experiment is canned. It's all worked out. You put it in the book, and the kids do it. And so what? But is there a way to develop the experiment over the years? Is there a way for students to interact with you and go, "Wow, we did that. But what if we did this? Could that improve?" I mean, how are we getting the students actually involved in the experimental process like a real scientist, where the experiments are improved and improved and improved, and we get better and better data? So I've enjoyed doing that with my students with a lot of the experiments I'm going to show you today. Here's some goals for good labs. We need a good intellectual challenge, a good problem that has a solution that we can arrive at, and some way of evaluating our results. So typically in physics, that's by way of the experimental error that you calculate bullet point number two, a clear pathway for predicting the values that you want to see and measuring them and comparing these. Some of the activities I'm going to show you, the first time I developed them, we were getting, 10 to 15% experimental error using really cheap equipment. I thought that was pretty good. We were all out having a blast pushing my pickup truck around in the parking lot and getting 15% error. Oh, that's a kick. Okay, now we use equipment and we get the error down to 5%. Okay, but that was 10 years later after our school had the money to buy the equipment. I did it with cheap stuff for a long time. So that's what I would encourage you to do. The equipment can be everyday stuff or it can be high-tech stuff. I'm going to show you some of both. But it should be things that we should, that should be interesting to learn about. Not an object that's a special device that only works here that we'll never think about again. And all labs should involve, well, in physics anyway, they should generally involve quantitative interaction with what's going on, and so on. Finally, deep is better than frequent. One of the things that I deplored about teaching in the public schools, in Texas anyway, I don't know how it is everywhere else, but in Texas back in the 80s, I don't even know how it is in Texas right now, but back in the 80s when I started teaching, the state requirement was that 40% of class time had to be spent in the lab. And so it was just so superficial. We're just spending all our time just trying to make up stuff to do in the lab to meet this requirement. And what I do now is I do six labs a year with my ninth grade science class, three in the fall, three in the spring. And they're good, solid experiments. And then they spend a couple of weeks preparing the report from it. And the reports are great. I'll show you at the end about the lab report handbook that I wrote in case you aren't aware of it. But what happens every single year at our school is that we get students coming back at homecoming or perhaps better even spring break or at the end of the year. And they say, "Here's what happened to me last year. My TA, when I turned in my lab, my TA looked at it and said, 'How in the world did you learn how to write a lab report like that?'" And the TAs are always overjoyed. They say, "Nobody knows how to do this." "Well, I learned it in high school." And that's what makes our lab substantive, is you interact with the equipment, you calculate your predictions, and then you write up a real report, not fill in the blank stuff in the lab book. And so going in deep like this, less frequently, is sort of a common theme throughout classical education. Deep. Fewer things done deeply is better than many things done shallowly. Now here's a few caveats about what I'm about to show you. It's real easy to think up some wow thing to do in your classroom that doesn't really have any avenue for the students to explore quantitatively. In other words, it's a wow factor without the substance. So if that's all it is, now I am going to show you a couple of explosions just for fun at the end. But those are demos that I just couldn't help but show you. In case you don't know how to blow up coffee creamer, you're about to see full audio. But that's a demo, all right, when we get to collision theory in chemistry. But for the labs that the kids are doing, they shouldn't just be, not at the high school level, they shouldn't just be watch something happen and write a paragraph about it or answer a few questions. They need to be a quantitative, analytical engagement with physics, where you use physics to make predictions, you make measurements, you worry about the process of making measurements, the precision involved in the measurements, you calculate your experimental results, you compare them to your predictions, and your analysis involves your error, sources of error, and so on. Right? So that needs to be there in your student's laboratory experience. Another thing about making up your own labs is that it might be that the experiment doesn't work well at first, but that's part of the fun. Okay, you're now an experimentalist, and being an experimental physicist is hard. So it's okay to show that to your students. One of the things I'm doing right now, I have the great blessing of having a laser optics lab at our school by virtue of a wonderful gift a few years ago. So I've been developing this laser optics lab where we use really nice equipment. So one of the things we've been working on for the last semester is, we just spent a year and a half working on one project, trying lots of things that didn't work. It involved computer automation, programming, optics, lasers, data analysis, numerical differentiation. This is all with 9th and 10th graders. They eat it up. They don't mind it. It takes a year and a half, and we're still not done. I'm teaching them how to be patient in the lab. That's one of the hallmarks of laboratory research, is it takes a year and a half just to find out that you didn't do it right, and you still got more work to do. And we just finished we're still in the middle of a project to build our own I always get those words mixed up. Not the chemistry one, but these. You know, the one that spreads out the colors. Spectroscope. I always get those two words mixed up. So we're trying to make our own spectroscope by making a slot, putting it through a cylindrical lens, using a laboratory camera to capture the split out colors, put them on the screen. It's a lot harder than it looks. I thought it would be easy, but it's not. So we keep trying stuff. They don't mind that it takes forever. Sometimes, though, you have to just throw an idea out because it just can't. It just doesn't work, not without buying really expensive equipment. And finally, a lot of the stuff I'm going to show you you need somebody who's a handyman to help. Now, I am a handyman, so I've been building stuff all my life. So it's fun for me to put these things together. If that doesn't work for you, then, I don't know, get the students involved would be my first thing to think. Build the stuff in the lab. It takes time from your course, but probably be worth it to do that once a year until you build up a repertoire of equipment. So, with that, let's go through a few lab ideas. This is the first thing I do with my 9th grade students. I do the pendulum lab. Oh, by the way, I should say, I am in the process of putting the experiments that I show you today, along with a number of others, I'm in the process of writing a book with those in it, with full background information for the teachers and so on. So if all this information today looks like, wow, I'd like to do that, but I need all the details, I hope in a, it's probably going to be a year, but I hope to have a book out someday with all of this. So the Pendulum Lab, I do it in the second week maybe of ninth grade. It's so simple. So here's the materials involved. A piece of string, a paper clip, and a couple of heavy steel washers. All right? That's what you have to go buy. You've already got meter sticks in your room and a book to lay on it to hold it still. So the point of this lab is to explore how the scientific method works, which we review at the beginning of the year. But more than that, to get in a little bit to the problem of trying to look at how three different variables can affect the outcome of an experiment and how to manipulate them one at a time so that you can tell which one made the difference. So the question, so it's, this isn't really about learning how pendulums work, although that's fun. And the students, when they do a little background reading on it, they learn about Galileo and all of that. The real point is, how do we manipulate one variable at a time so that in the end we can look at the data and see the answer to our question? So the experimental question is, what are the factors that affect the period of a pendulum? That's the question I pose to the students. What are the factors that affect the period? Now, the first thing we have to do is talk about what the period is. So we do that. Then we just brainstorm in class. What do you think are the factors that kind of affect the period of a pendulum? And so it doesn't take very long for them to come up with the three possibilities: the length of the string, the mass on the end, and the what I call the starting angle, how far back you pull it when you let it go. They come up with those pretty quickly. So then we have to talk about, now, how can we design an experiment that would allow us to test these one at a time? This takes a good half an hour to go through. But in the end of the conversation, this is what we come up with. We need four tables like this one. Four different tables, all right? This one is for a long string with a heavy mass. And now we've got to compare results for a small starting angle and a large starting angle. And we're going to do each three times. So here's how I have them do it. The period of this pendulum is only about... it's less than 1 second. So that's so fast that it's hard to time it. So we talk about an easier way to get the same information is to have one of your team members be the person looking at the clock. And he says go. He says stop 10 seconds apart. And you've got another person counting swings. And you just do the number of swings in 10 seconds, which contains the same information. If you wanted to, you could actually calculate what the period is, but since the period isn't the question, I don't have them calculate that. The period is the question is what influenced the period. So we divide the team up. You've got one person holding the pendulum to release it, and his job is to release it in the same place every time that we do a new trial. Then you've got another person who's the clock watcher, and her job is to say ready, set, go, and stop. And you've got another person who's counting the swings. So I tell them to count the swings in quarter swing increments. So from here all the way over to here, that's a half a swing. If it's straight down when the stop is called, then you're either at a one quarter or three quarters of a swing. All the way back is one full swing. And that's what goes in the box. And in their report, they need to label what those numbers mean. They can't just put numbers in a box. The numbers have to be identified. This is the number of swings in a 10-second interval. So then they make four of these tables, one of them for long string heavyweight. Now, then I tell them, now I've set this up this way because the easiest thing to change in the experimental setup is the angle, right? You can change that without affecting any other equipment. So let's do the two angles for one setup at the same time. Now, what's the next easiest thing to change? The masses. Because the masses are attached to the string with a bent paper clip. Just use a big paper clip and bend it open to make a hook. And so you can put on one mass and then one washer. I use these huge washers, like half-inch holes in the middle. and then put three washers on for the heavyweight. So you can just clink, clink, just add on a couple of washers. Now you got your heavyweight set up. Same length of string. So the table for this one is long string, heavyweight. And then we do small angle, start, large angle. So far, what they will see is that you get the same number of swings in 10 seconds, no matter what. So at this point, they're starting to go, well, it looks like nothing affects the period. And then they go to a short string. And then all of a sudden, the numbers, instead of 5 or 6 swings in 10 seconds, it's 9 or 10 swings in 10 seconds. And it will stay that way, no matter what else they do. So one of the things I tell them is to make sure a detail that matters is that when you change the length of your string, you need to make a significant change. Like the new string length needs to be roughly half the length of the one you started with. All right, square root of L over G, right? The period change is going like the square root of the change in the length. So if you just change it 10%, you're not going to see much difference. So I tell them tie the string so it's half as long. This is a great experiment. They see how to manipulate variables, and what's even more important, when they write the report, this is their first try at writing a real lab report. So it's the opportunity to learn all the ins and outs of writing lab reports, language, tables of data, analysis. But the physics involved is pretty straightforward. The question is very simple. So it gives them an opportunity to do some hard stuff where the physics itself isn't what's confusing them. And then when we get to some experiments later that more physically challenging, cognitively, by then they've got more experience writing their report. So they're not trying to do everything at once. This is the first lab I do each year with my seniors in physics. The bullseye lab, I call it. This is so much fun. Now, I set this up as a competition between all the teams in the room. The winners will receive T-shirts like this. And years ago, before any of the other departments in the school were doing this, I struck a deal with the administration that the winners of the Bullseye Lab competition in my physics class each year could wear their T-shirts to school on exam day for the rest of the year, their senior year. So it's a real highly valued prize. So on the back, there's a target, and on the front, this is not silk screen. That's embroidered into the shirt. Regents Physics Bullseye Lab champions, highly coveted. Such a simple lab, just like the one before. The parts cost for this is negligible. That is a ramp made of a piece of steel bookshelf bracket that you can buy at Home Depot for $1. There's a clamp that I bought from Home Depot for $5. And then the rest of, and then a meter stick, and I don't see the steel ball, but they run a steel ball down this ramp. You need a stopwatch. That's a plumb bob that I'll explain in a moment. This thing is just bothering me. It's ringing. Maybe I'll step over here. So the point of this lab is to predict where the ball is going to land when it hits the floor. Simple projectile motion calculation. In fact, it's a projectile motion calculation that's almost exactly the same as one of the calculations that's going to appear on the test a couple of weeks later. So by the time they get to the test, there will be no excuse for not being able to calculate what's on the test because it's the same. So they mark off an interval on the tabletop here. The table is nice and level and very smooth. These are my lab tables. So if you don't have those, you would need to find a surface that's very level and very smooth. Like those white folding tables won't work. The surface is too rough. And they bow in the middle and stuff. So you need a good flat surface. So you get your ring stand here. My table's, if you ever have the money to build a science lab, get these. I knew about these when we built this building, so I specified them. These sockets in the lab table so you can put a ring stand right in it. Now you don't have a support stand. Now you don't have those bases to worry about for the rest of your life. So it's a real nice little device. So we put a stand in there, we clamp this ramp on. I tell them to make the ramp's angle pretty small, because if the ball's going very fast, they're not going to be able to get very accurate timing as it goes through this timing zone right here, and their calculation of the ball's initial velocity will contain too much error, and they won't hit the target. So the slower the ramp is, the easier it will be to time the ball. So they mark this off, and then I tell them, if your ball falls off the table during your timing exercises, it's an automatic 30-point deduction off of your lab report grade. Period. Because I don't want anybody to accidentally roll the ball off and get a nice hint of where the ball's going to land. All right? That's not fair. So all the teams are competing. It's not fair for you to go, oops, I dropped the ball, and it landed right there. Okay? If it falls off, that's a big penalty. So, boy, they really did guard this. Had one group last year actually brought one of my lab carts around to the end of the table so the ball would just fall in the cart. And that way they didn't have to worry about it. I love those kind of improv ideas. So they time the ball, they sit down, they calculate how fast it's going, and then they use the principles of projectile motion, the height of the table, to figure out where it's going to land. But now the table has a lip that hangs out, and how we get that edge projected down onto the floor so that we can measure out from it, that's what the plumb bob is for. So I bought one plumb bob at Home Depot for $5 or $10 or whatever, and you put a string on it, and that allows them to project the edge of the table down onto the floor, and they measure out from that. And I give them a photocopied target, which they tape down to the floor, and then I get a piece of carbon paper. I put it face down on the target. They get one shot, roll the ball. When it lands on the carbon paper, it makes a big black dot on the target. And everybody waits with bated breath while we peel away the carbon paper, and there's a dot. And it's either the, glory of victory or the agony of defeat. It's very fun. This lab costs almost nothing. You got to buy a 1-inch diameter steel ball from Flynn Scientific or somebody. So the parts cost is just literally a few dollars. And it's probably one of the most funnest labs we do all year. And of course we do it first, and then we get to wear the t-shirts for the rest of the year for the winners. A couple of years ago, I actually had one group of students whose ball, now, I didn't show an image of this, but I don't consider lateral deflection from the center of the target, because the ramp actually on my tables, there's one of these support sockets down here, and I took the hardware off of it so that it wouldn't be in the way, but there's still a hole, and they have to be a little at an angle to miss that hole. So there's just unavoidable the way my room is set up. But even if I didn't have the hole there, getting that ramp straight is really not part of what we're trying to figure out, and so it doesn't matter too much. If you're 1 degree off, the distance you're going isn't going to change by any significant amount. So lateral displacement from the center of the target doesn't affect their error calculation. It's only displacement in the direction of travel. And we're calculating the error by, it's not how far you are from the line, I predicted the horizontal travel from the end of the table to the line was 30 centimeters, and our measurement is that it's 29.5 centimeters, and those are the two numbers you use to calculate your error, so the error should be very low. I have had students miss the target completely. The ball didn't hit the carbon paper, 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. I've also had students hit on the line with such precision that the error was not measurable. The error was 0.0%. Wow, that was a fun day. Great experiment. So, moving right along. This is my favorite one, and this is the ninth grade. I used to call this the pickup truck lab because I did this for 15 years with my pickup truck. I had three different pickup trucks. Now I don't have a pickup truck anymore because I traded in my old F-150 on this new Kia Soul. Sometimes, just have to move on. But it's really fun. I got the idea for this back in the 80s from, I think, an article in the Physics Teacher or somewhere like that. But I have been unable to find it now to cite the reference. So I don't know where that is. But here's the way it works. This is a rather complicated lab, but it's so much fun. The bottom line is we want to compare. We're investigating Newton's second law of motion. We want to predict how fast this vehicle will accelerate when different forces are applied to it. And so we get its mass. I take it down to a garden shop where they have a truck scale, and I get the mass of the car with a full tank of gas and a driver. I get out of the car because I'm not going to be the driver during experiment. One of my kids is. So I get the empty car, full tank. And then we calculate, all right, if we apply 125 newtons or 175 newtons or 250 newtons, what will the acceleration be? And we look at a graph of A versus F. So the slope is 1 over M. And it's a nice linear graph. So this is a great opportunity to have a long discussion with the students about proportionality and all that. Then, on lab day, we push the car with those forces and we time it as it accelerates from rest over a 10-meter timing zone that we've marked out on the parking lot. So one of the things that's fun here is that we are out in the parking lot in front of the whole school with the whole class. So you can imagine how much fun that is. I mean, we have grammar school kids come out to watch. Visitors are watching. We're all out there for 45 minutes doing this lab. It's so much fun. So let me show you. Now, here you can see the way I did the lab this year for the first time with the sole. One of the things I liked about the sole is that the back of the vehicle here was very close to vertical. So the bracket that I made to hold these things, these force measurement platforms, it was real easy to attach. I'll show you in a moment a slide of how this thing is attached to the car. But before I do, let me tell you about these. I did this lab for 10 years with bathroom scales that I bought for $8.99 from Target. You're talking about cheap, right? So just tell the student to put the bathroom scale up against the back of the tailgate of the pickup truck and hold it there by friction. Just when you push, it'll stay there. All right? And so now as they push, we're going to say, ready, set, go. And the driver in the truck is going to pop her foot off the brake. And the pushers are already preloaded with the right amount of force. I tell them, you know, get it on there and hold it on there. When I say go, don't push harder. Push the same amount. The urge is always to push harder when you hear them say go, to get the truck going. So don't do that. Same amount of force. The truck's not going to move initially. It's going to start accelerating very, very slowly. And it's going to take 20 seconds maybe to go 10 meters. But we've got our stopwatch girl at the other end waiting for the bumper to cross the finish line. And as soon as it does, click. And how much time, we write the time down in our lab journals. Our criterion for collecting data is we have to have 3 trials for each set of forces that are within a 1 second range from the lowest measurement to the highest time measurement. That's a total range in the data of 1 second. That's how we get consistency. So at first they won't be within 1 second. The brakes have to get polished. I usually drive my car around the parking lot a couple of times holding the brake on to polish the oxidation off the brake, the discs before we start the lab. Otherwise there's too much friction. Now another thing we do, is measure the friction so that we can deduct that from the force that's being applied to the truck so that we can get better predictions. This will improve the accuracy. This will take at least 5% error out. So what we do is we get in the most level place we can and we push the truck. I tell one boy, push the truck as slowly as you can without it stopping. So he's just going along like this, right? How much force does it take to keep it moving at a constant speed? And it's hard to get an estimate because when you're pushing, the force needles are just bouncing all over the place. It's really hard. But it's funny because it kind of averages out. So it works pretty well. And so we get a measurement for the friction force, and then we deduct that from the nominal forces that are being applied by the pushers to calculate the net force that's causing the acceleration. That's what we use for our predictions for the accelerations. The accelerations are going to be measured by calculating 2d over t squared based on the time data, the average of the 3 times that we take that are all within 1 second of one another. If a time doesn't fall within that window, we toss it out and we keep doing it until we get three times that are within 1 second. So I did this with bathroom scales for 10 years, and it works really well. It's easy, actually, to get a pretty solid linear trend in the acceleration that you can easily compare point by point with the predicted values. I like to use at least four different force values. The reason is, with three, if they're in an arc, it's not persuasive that the arc isn't going to continue that way. You know, with four, you tend to get more of a zigzag that's going to follow, you know, a linear trend in a data set. So I would use at least four different force values. Now, as our school got larger and we had more money to put into the science budget, I eventually did graduate from bathroom scales to force measurement platforms that you can get. They're from Pasco. If you haven't used any Pasco equipment, I keep that kind of equipment more or less at arm's length because I don't really believe in overloading my classroom with gee whiz electronic toys. I think it's just better not to. The benefit of packing your classroom out with fancy gadgets isn't as high, I think, as is advertised. But I like to use them for specific tasks that are difficult to do otherwise, and this is one of them. So I'll show you a couple. I'll talk more about these force readers in a moment when I show you a couple of slides about how these things are attached. So this picture is a picture of the bracket that I built before I. I've actually done this in three phases. My first era was bathroom scales on the back of the tailgate. For that, we don't need any bracket. You just get the bathroom scales out there, a stopwatch, a meter tape to mark off 10 meters, some duct tape on the ground. That's all you need. So this experiment can be done for $20. Using equipment that's clear to everyone what its purpose is. We know what a stopwatch is. We know what a bathroom scale does. So there are no mysteries about these devices. Then I graduated to using these Pasco force platforms, but they're very heavy and they need a way to be attached to the car. So when I was doing it first with a pickup truck, I built this bracket. It's hard to see, but right there on the end is a vertical a piece of closet dowel rod to go into the rear stake hole of the pickup truck. And then there's some eye hooks here for the top of the platforms to attach to, and there's a lip across the bottom to support the weight. And this thing just plops onto the back of my pickup truck. And then this past year I graduated to the new Kia Soul, so this platform had to be modified. So I chopped the ends off and I cut these holes in here and put these straps in. And here they are. This is the outside of the car. This is the back seat of the car. So I have these tie-down straps going around the headrests. And to protect the car from getting scratched, you can see that I have some foam here. I went down to a swimming pool supply shop. These are flotation devices, like noodles, only they're flat, and which makes them better for this purpose. And I attached them to the wood using rubber cement. Perfect. It also gives some cushion, allows us to cinch the tie downs up and get a good snug fit. So it didn't hurt my car at all to do this. You can see here are the two force platforms of I'm not necessarily suggesting that only boys can push, but and I have had some years where girls did a good job pushing, but it's pretty hard work and the girls usually give out. So if they want to do it, I tell them, look, it's really hard. You're going to have to really do your part. So is that what you want? And this is, you know, early in the year in Texas, it's still pretty hot. So you're going to get sweaty. Is this what you want? And if they insist, I say, okay, you can do it. But I know these football players over here are champing the bit. If you'd rather take it easy this morning, it's up to you. They usually bow out because the boys are just yeah, I want to push the car. I want to push the car. So that's where they push. Then there's these cables here that go to the force readers that they need to look at to monitor their force, which you can see in this set of pictures. So we need two lovely assistants walking side by side with the two pushers, and they are holding the force reader devices right in front of the pusher's face. And the pusher, the device can be set so that it has a digital display or an analog display with a digital readout above it. The analog display is much better because when you're trying to analogly, you know, modify your force, watching digital numbers jump around doesn't help. But a meter moving, you can move with the meter, and that's what you need to have it set on. And you can also have a reader above digital so you can actually see the number. You can also take data with these readers, so you can actually collect the data, which I don't do every year, but one year I did, just to analyze what do the forces look like. And that's where I discovered you get this big spike at the beginning when we get the go signal, because the boys are all jazzed and they hear go and they really push it. So then I learned to tell them not to do that. You also can see the force fade as the car picks up speed. So then that allowed me to tell them, don't fade, don't fade. So while they're pushing, you know, the car starts to rest, I'm walking right along, coaching them as they go. Steady, steady, keep the force, right on 200 newtons, right on 200 newtons. And as the car's picking up speed, hold it, keep going, push, don't fade. So that they're, and by the time they've done this three or four times, they're getting a good workout, especially with the higher forces. So it's so much fun. Also for measuring friction, now that I have the force platform thing, what I do is even more sophisticated. We actually collect the data file for the forces during the friction test, and the reader will calculate the mean of all the data points in the file so that we can get the mean value of the force it took to push it at a constant speed, get a nice accurate figure for what the friction actually is. In the lab report, they have to show me a graph with the predicted values in their perfect line and the experimental values side by side, on the same graph, I mean, on the same axes, and they calculate the experimental error for all four data points. And with this equipment here, the error is usually below 5%. It's just really great. And the students always want to blame the error on the forces bouncing around. I tell them, okay, that's great. But, you know, we have this one-second criterion for the forces. The times have to be within a second, one-second window. So we are kind of accounting for the variation in the forces by requiring that our times meet a certain criterion for consistency. So how does that play into your appeal to the variation in the force to account for our experimental error? Maybe you need to appeal to something else. Oh, a parking lot maybe is sloped. Well, the parking lot is sloped. All parking lots are sloped. Rain, you know. So the parking lot is sloped, and that affected the results. Yeah, well, our friction measurement took that into account because depending on the way the slope is, that number is going to be folded into the friction measurement. So that doesn't help you explain it either. So you're going to have to work really hard to come up with good substantive explanations for what's causing the error. This year, you see the hatch back open on my car. We did this on a fairly windy day. That thing acts like a sail and makes a big difference in the way this lab performs. Nobody thought of that. But I did it six. I did it six times this year. In the future, I'm going to try to combine these classes, do it before school or something. But I did it six times this year, and only one of them was a windy day, so I could easily see the effect that was caused by having that hatch up, which I didn't anticipate would be as large as it was. All right, that was the most complicated lab. The other ones are much more simple, so we'll kind of get through these, and I want to have some time at the end. Oh, okay. I'll pick up the pace. I want to have time for questions. The Hot Wheels lab I do with ninth graders. This is another thing that they love to do. Hot Wheels. In fact, have five different Hot Wheels cars in your little set and let them choose which one. Okay, I've got a Jaguar and all this. They love that. So I built this little bracket here out of a piece of Hot Wheels track. And some aluminum. You can see the aluminum angle large here and a little smaller aluminum angle there. I just attached it all together with JB Weld. If you don't know what JB Weld is, it's the greatest glue ever invented. It's a two-part epoxy. You mix it together, you put some pieces of metal together, and you come back tomorrow, and they're there till the end of the world. And so when I first did this, when I first developed this, I did not have these fancy laser photogates for measuring times. We did it with a stopwatch, which means this support rail here was quite long. It was 8 feet. It was a full 8-foot length of aluminum, and the track went all the way down. That stretched out the timing marks so that you could time it with a stopwatch. So the error was, 10-15% range, but it was pretty reliable. We would obviously do it multiple times and get times that are consistent. But the point here is that it's a conservation of energy experiment. You measure how far the car is going to reduce its height, use that information to predict how fast it would be going, clock it as it goes between two marks, calculate its speed, compare your result to your prediction. So this, again, can be done very cheaply, and it's solid physics calculation. Careful measurements of vertically, you have to ask questions like, well, the car, what are you going to measure on the car? And the car is sitting on this track that lifts it up from the bracket a little bit. So we got to figure out how we're going to make our height measurements. But the track is, you buy a box of Hot Wheels junk at the Toys R Us for $10, and you're good to go. Get a couple of cars for another $10. And like I said, when I started, it's a meter stick and a stopwatch. So, under $30 for everything. Now, the digital world is much cooler. So, after doing this for 8 years, I finally could afford timing gates. So, you can get these from any supplier like Flynn, and they'll set you back a couple $100. But it's a laser eye that goes across the track. That's what these two holes are for. And they connect to this timer. And so the first eye is the start, and the last eye is the stop. And you can get a measurement to the 10,000th of a second of the car, the car's time. So the error now is very low. The problem with the long track is that even though Hot Wheels cars look like they slide real easily, there is actually a fair bit of friction. So you will lose a lot of velocity over a 6-foot flat where you're trying to time the car. And you just have to live with it. I tried everything. I tried WD-40 on the track and stuff. That doesn't help. That was as good as I could get it until I went to the photo gates. So again, there's a two-step way to do this. You can get a good solid lab going. The whole lab, it takes me 10 minutes to set this up. It takes us 20 minutes to do the lab. The most time-consuming part is making all height measurements like these students are doing here. Because I tell I want 3 or 4 different students to make this measurement. And let's put them in a table on the wall. And now you can take the mean height at the top and the mean height at the bottom, the mean value of the distance between the gates, and use these this way. So it takes more time now if you make every measurement multiple times. Very similar to this is a lab I do with the seniors physics. It's the same idea, only now we have a rolling steel ball, so there's rotational kinetic energy involved in the conservation of energy equation. And to calculate the predicted value, you now have to correlate, rotating angular velocities to linear velocities. One of the complicating factors is that when the ball sits in this track, the radius of the ball that is attached to the moment of inertia of the ball is different from the radius that it's rolling on. Because it's not rolling on a flat, it's rolling on a track. The ball is sitting down in the track. So if you draw a picture of that and look at the geometry, you will easily see that the Pythagorean theorem can be used to determine the rolling radius, I call it, versus the ball's radius. And you can take that into account when you're relating the linear velocity of the ball to the angular velocity of the ball. It's not difficult, but it's a thing to think about. And then this thing takes literally seconds to perform. You just measure the mass of the ball and the height differences, and then you stick it on there, and Of course, I know you don't need to actually measure the mass of the ball, but I have them do it anyway. And if they want to cancel the masses out before they make the prediction, that's up to them. And then you get your times. So it's the same idea. It's just got rotational kinetic energy in there. Finally, this is one I do in senior physics. Look how cheap this lab is. I got a 9-volt battery. I got a screaming siren that I bought from Radio Shack that is deafening. And a sound level meter that I bought from Radio Shack for about $30. I a couple of years ago bought a box of earplugs for all of us to wear, because that thing will shatter your ears. So I get a stool out there. I put a piece of copper pipe that I bought at Home Depot. So the parts cost for all this stuff is just a few bucks. That'll set you back $30, but that's a one-time purchase. You need this meter tape here. And so the idea here is you use the inverse square law to predict sound pressure levels at different distances. We go out to 20 meters. We do this out, I didn't photograph it here, but we actually do this out in the middle of the practice field to get as far away as we can from all buildings and stuff. Use the 1 meter SPL measurement to calculate the intensity at that point using the logarithms, and then use that intensity in the inverse square law to predict what the intensities will be at all other measurements. Then convert those all to SPLs, and then make your SPL measurements, and then use those to compare. And you can have a nice discussion with your students why it makes more sense to compare SPL measurements than intensity measurements. Intensities are very small numbers. A little bit of difference can cause 100 or 300% error. SPL measurements are all, 80 decibels or 60. A little bit of difference gives you a little bit of error. Makes more sense. So this thing takes almost no time to do. It's very cheap, and it's makes you a great inverse square law graph, and you can look at your data, and it'll track it just right. I put the thing on slow, so this averaging makes it easier to measure. We wait for the number to get to a lowest reading so that the wind and stuff isn't affecting the reading. Call it when it's at its lowest value. We have three different students do the whole set of readings. We take the mean value of the readings at each location. It's a great lab. Very easy to do. And again, no specialized equipment. There's nothing here that anybody has trouble understanding what it's for. The sound level meter, okay, that's a new device. We have to learn about that. But this is a regular piece of equipment that people use all the time for things. It's nothing weird about it. All right, that brings me to my two demos that you've been waiting all semester to see. I love throwing sodium into a bucket of water. I'm going to show you me doing this year. I've got the audio track playing so you can hear the students while I'm doing this. This is so cool. Now, I'll tell you, after you blow up sodium, if you've never done this before, the sodium, when it evolves hydrogen, that's what's actually blowing up. So you go through the chemistry with them. But the explosion, whatever sodium hasn't reacted yet, is going to be melted and blown out of the water tub and will land in little splotches around on the sidewalk. And then when you hose it down, they burst into flames. Now, this year I only had one of them, and you can't really see the flame in the video. You can see a little plume of smoke come out. Some years I have 10 or 20 little different flames erupting out of the water while I'm hosing down the sidewalk. The kids love that. In fact, you'll hear my co-teacher say, "This is my favorite part." All right, so here we go. Uh-oh. I hit the button twice.
Is it? Tell me, Natalie.
I don't know.
Run!
Wait, was that it?
Oh, yeah.
I like this part the best.
Okay, watch her part.
Yeah, look.
Do you want me to hold you up?
Okay, that's kind of it. The rest is just me hosing down the sidewalk without any more fire. So, did you hear that student? There was you see a little flame in the water before the detonation actually happens. Did you hear that student go, "Is that it?" And then right then it goes, boom! It was so funny. I really love that. So, here's another demonstration that we've just done for 2 years. I had a boy whose plan is to study explosives engineering at, like, there's one college in the whole United States that has that degree. But he's been planning this since he was a young child. And he came into my class, and he was so excited that we were going to do all these things because now he can learn the chemistry behind the explosions that he's been studying all his life. He was great. So he comes in, he goes, and we're talking about collision theory and about, you know, more surface area makes a reaction happen faster and that, so sawdust is explosive and logs of wood are not. So he said, "Did you know you can blow up coffee creamer?" I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, coffee creamer. It's just carbon, right? So what you do is you get a coffee can, and we're going to do it twice, with a 1 pound can and a 3 pound can. So the 1 pound, you put a little thin layer of black powder on the bottom of the can. There's a hole in the bottom for a fuse to go in. You put a coffee filter or paper towel down on top of the black powder, and then you fill the can about 2/3 full with Cremora. And then you light the fuse. The black powder, when it ignites, it ejects the contents out of the can so that they, you know, you get them all, you get the air all fluffed up into the particles. But you also have the heat from the black powder going off that ignites the carbon in the coffee creamer. And it's nice. So you're going to see it twice. The first one made more fire. But the second one, you can actually see the double detonation. You can see it go boom, boom, like that, if you look carefully. So the first one is with the 1 pound can.
This is at my
We use sandbags to make sure we don't get any fragments from the cans. We're actually standing.
We have to walk.
Here we go.
Quite a ways away, 50 yards from us.
Ride, Chris, ride.
There goes the fuse.
Oh, yeah.
This is loud as a howitzer.
I was like, oh,
just here's my books. While you're looking at that, I'll just tell you that we have so many students now that I don't like doing these demonstrations over and over. So we found a common time we could bring them all out, which means the whole school wants to come out because they remember doing this last year. So we got 200 kids out there watching this explosion. It's so much fun. Teaching science so the students learn science. Here's the Student Lab Report Handbook. This is a new book that I've just finished. It's a text for the science class for ninth grade that I'm teaching, where I'm using some of the labs that we talked about today. That book is now available in a digital review copy. The actual published hardback for students will be available in 1 year. So if you want to review it to consider perhaps using it in your school, send me an email and request a review copy. It's the review CD is $20 plus $5 shipping. The Student Lab Report Handbook is $19, and the Teaching Science, which I hope all of you would read because I wrote it for you and I think it's worth reading, and that's what people tell me. They say it's very good description of the philosophy and practice behind teaching science includes a chapter at the end on dealing with the evolution issue in a way that can, and from what I've seen, make almost everybody happy. And so all of the first two, they're all, you can get the information about all of them on my website, which is barely visible at the bottom of the screen. And once again, if you'll, I would love to get your names on my newsletter distribution list. So that's here. We got 10 minutes or so for questions. Maybe five. No, one. How about anybody have a question or comment? Yes, in the back. Ninth grade is the introductory, and then 12th grade is the actual vector physics. Yeah, all you need is algebra. Algebra 1. Yeah. And they can be taken concurrently, or if they're accelerated, then they've had it probably the previous year. So we have two different physics classes for those two different math groups. One of them includes the chemistry, and the other one just stays on the physics, so it goes a little slower. But it's just linear equations. Yes? You need to get enough force on the car to get it to accelerate enough so you can actually get some good data, and that takes two guys to do it. If you push with 50 pounds on the back of a truck, that's really hard to hold that while the truck's accelerating. 50 pounds is about as high as you can go. A football player can barely do that. But 50 pounds is not enough to get the truck to do much. But 100 pounds will. So that's why we always use two. Thanks for coming, and be glad to talk with you later. Thank you.